Were there schools at that time that didn't have specific endo departments?
I think the Department of Michigan was a straight Department of Endodontics, yeah. It wasn't at Pennsylvania, it was under, well, I think Grossman actually came under Dr. Burkett's direction. I'm not sure that it's separated yet, but, and you know, when we started up at Washington, we started the Department of Periodontics and Endodontics, and we had oral path, oral histology, and everything else, just because we had such a shortage of faculty that we had to substitute in all these other areas. It took us years to get to that point. It wasn't until I left that they separated the Department of Periodontics and Endodontics. Gene Natkin took over.
I heard that NYU had originally a very early separation of departments.
They might well have had, yeah. I'll have to admit, I'm not too familiar with NYU. I'd
spoken to Mike Auerbach.
Yeah, well.
And he really went into...
Well, believe me, Mike was one of the pioneers, and no question about it.
You had mentioned this morning that when you got out of school, I think you said 1942, you were really facing the era where focal infection was, you know, really ingrained. What was it like to practice that? Dealing with that, being in, you know, an endodontic situation?
Well, really, you know, I can't speak to 42 because I almost went directly into the service. And during that period of time, well, I do recall during that period of time, my dear friend Alex Link, the guy who got me started in perio, my God, he used to lecture me all the time about the theory of focal infection. He was absolutely convinced, and he was a product of the University of Southern California, where it was strong, too. He was absolutely convinced that the pulpless tooth was going to condemn the patient to death, and anybody that had a pulpless tooth had to be a fool. And I think he was a pretty good example of the mentality of the time. As I say, I came out of a different educational system, and I think if we ever heard about the theory of focal infection when we were in school, there wasn't any great emphasis placed on it. And the faculty at Northwestern just didn't place that much emphasis on it.
Do you think it was based on, at this time, do you think it was still based on Hunter's paper?
No.
Or was it just that root canal therapy was so crude at this time and shortly before that success or failure was not really that predictable?
Well, I think it was based mostly on Rosenau's work. And most of the time, why you'd either hear this work referred to or Billings' work at the University of Chicago. Because they had the medical profession absolutely convinced that, pulpless tooth and tonsils and adenoids and appendices and all of these things that came under such great surgical attack back in the after the First World War, that these all had to be removed. And gosh, there were patients that went in and had all their teeth extracted, had everybody had their tonsils out at the time. All you had to do is just get a pain in the belly and you were in getting your appendix out. It was the age of the surgeon, believe me. Harry Sisher had a statement that he used to make. If all the teeth that were extracted because of the theory of focal infection were placed in a pile, they would make the skull pyramids of Genghis Khan put them to shame. And, that was blood and vulcanite, period. Lots of extraction. We haven't gotten over from it yet. We haven't recovered from it yet. Still a big part of dentistry to extract teeth.
Why was Rosenau so into it?
Well, first of all, he was a MD bacteriologist, I think because he was based at Mayo Clinic, that gave him great stature. When you go back and read his work and look at what he did, it's absolutely ridiculous how the medical profession particularly could have fallen for that stuff. You know, where he made massive infusions of bacteria and injected them into animals, and these animals just died from overwhelming infections. And then he'd take all their organs apart and look at them under a microscope and see, didn't I tell you that's exactly what would happen if you had these dead teeth or these bad tonsils or so on. And it was just taken as the gospel. And believe me, there are things we're doing now, and certainly in medicine and in dentistry that are going to appear just as ridiculous in the future. I had a herniorrhaphy the other day. I was out of the hospital the next day. I was swimming on the fifth day. You know, you used to spend 2 weeks in the hospital after you had a hernia repair. And that was the gospel. And then you were told, my God, don't climb stairs and don't walk and don't drive a car and all these ridiculous things. But that was the gospel of the time. And focal infection was the gospel, and it reigned for 20 or 30 years before the antibiotics came in. You start giving patients antibiotics, and it didn't do a thing for their arthritis. But they got rid of their infections, but they still had their arthritis, and then we finally realized how foolish it was. And then I think also, again, it's interesting that it was the Mayo Clinic that kind of put the death knell on the whole thing by the development of cortisone there by Kendall and Hinch. And that was about, 1950 or 51. Absolutely dramatic turnaround. Management of arthritic patients. A great piece of work, you know, that deserved the Nobel Prize that they got. But finally, people realized, the focal infection must not be true. It must not cause arthritis. Something else got to do with it.
Let me ask you something that you touched upon. What things do you see that we're doing now that will be put to, that will be laid to rest in the future?
Well, I think filling root canals with the materials that we are right now. Well, I said this 10, 12 years ago, too, so it isn't necessarily true. But
in what respect?
Well, the way we're filling root canals right now is too traumatic. There are a couple of papers at this meeting. There are a couple of papers reported recently in the literature about the strains that we're introducing into the tooth by the filling methods that we use. I'm just as responsible for this as anyone, and it's just leading to later fracture. And we've got to come up with a less traumatic method of filling canals. We certainly are going to have to come up with better preventive methods. We've got to protect the pulp. But I'm sure there's some things we're doing now that are going to look foolish down the line.
That's what I'm trying to put you on the spot about.
Well, I'd have to say I probably am a little upset about the fact that that no medicaments are being used in canals. I'm not upset about the fact that the culture technique is not being used generally. That's probably a waste of time. But I am upset, I think, that medicaments are not being used. I think we ought to try to do what we can to kill the bacteria. We certainly should do everything we can to cleanse the canal as thoroughly as possible. One of the things that I think should certainly be done is something that should be used in the canal to open up the face of the dentine after the smear layer has been developed. And there's some work that's been done in certainly down at the University of Georgia and also by Titmarsh in New Zealand showing the importance of using some of these slight acids, like citric acid, primarily acetic acid in the canals, to open up the canals so that they can be better cleansed and better filled. I think some of these things in the future are going to be in a gentler way. Maybe this device here that you showed me, the warming gutta percha and placing it with a syringe instead of forcing it in with wedges like we've been doing, is going to be a better way of filling canals in the future. Let's hope so.
Let me touch on one more thing, and then I think you've given me more than I can ask for. The AAE.
Yeah.
You were involved right from the very beginning.
Well, I wasn't one of the original members. That was set up when I was in the service during the war. But I recall going to an AAE meeting in Chicago when I was a graduate student. So it must have been the midwinter meeting in 1948. I would imagine, I don't know whether they have records on that or not, but I would imagine that I joined probably at that time. And I started regularly attending the meetings after that and got to know the membership and got to know some of the real old-timers of the thing. Incidentally, when I was in the service in probably about 1944, I was stationed in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I attended a meeting of the Lincoln Dental Society, and Clyde Davis, who was the first president of the AAE, I believe, addressed that meeting. And talk about an irascible son of a bitch, boy, that was Clyde Davis. Exacting, compulsive, irascible. He was a pretty old man at the time, but you know, one of the giants nonetheless. He had guts enough to believe in what he did and not let anybody talk him out of it. And he maintained that root canal therapy and partial pulpectomy, as he called it, pulpotomy, these things were a viable way of practicing dentistry and that they should not be removed from the curricula of dental schools. He had a real impact on the University of Nebraska, and I'd say in the Midwest. And he was really one of the giants, and I just was fortunate enough to attend a dental meeting where I heard him speak. And he got into a hell of a fight with somebody there over the word pulpotomy or partial pulpectomy. I'll never forget that. You know, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, but it was fortunate. Now, I think he was, maybe by the time the AAE was, by the time I started attending the AAE in 48, I think maybe Clyde Davis might have been dead, or at least he wasn't active at the time. Out here in California, there were only two or three people who were active. There was Dr. Hill and George Sharp. George Sharp practiced in Pasadena. He was one of the early members of the AAE. You have to give a lot of credit to those guys for recognizing the fact that there was a coterie of dentists around the United States who still believed in root canal therapy, and in spite of the abuse that they took from their colleagues and from medicine, why they still believed in the pulpless tooth and were willing to stake an organization on it. And we used to go to that meeting every year, have to travel by train from across the United States, 2 days each way, but nonetheless, it was an exciting period for me as a youngster.
Now, you were one of the original members of the board, weren't you?
I was on the first board, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What went on then? What type of feeling was prevalent in the organization?
Well, within the AAE, of course, there were detractors who didn't want a board. There were a lot of general practitioners in the AAE, as there are today, and they were upset about the fact that we would set up a board, that we would, literally make them second-class citizens. Well, we pointed out the fact that anybody... we finally got to the point where we were dickering with the American Dental Association to establish the board. It took years to do this, 6 years as I recall. we finally established the fact that we'd grandfather in these people if they had been practicing endodontics full-time for 5 years or half-time for 10 years. And that, or had the qualifications by having gone to school. So that's the way it started. I imagine that the founders of the board, there was not a one of us who had had full special training in endodontics per se. I probably came as close as anyone, maybe Lou Grossman. The rest of the guys learned it by the seat of their pants. And but it did tend to split the organization. But we went ahead bullheadedly. Now, I always was ambivalent about the board, even though I was on it, because I was upset that about the specialty of endodontics. I always felt that we should train undergraduate students in endodontics just as strongly as we did in operative dentistry. when they left dental school, they should be as competent to practice endodontics as most of the specialists of the time. And that was always my goal. I felt that if we had a board, we could upgrade the departments of endodontics in the schools of the nation. And I don't think that the board accomplished that. I think too much emphasis then got put on the graduate programs, and the undergraduate programs still suffered. There again, why there were a group who felt as I did, but we weren't very vocal about it.
I know that there's sort of a frustration in that the board is controlled by the general membership rather than the board being affiliated with the general membership and yet being autonomous.
Well, I just can't speak to that, Jay. I've been kind of out of the politics of the organization long enough now that I really can't speak to that. I don't have a sense of that.
Okay. What about the political control of the organization? It's been controlled for a long time by a relatively small number of people.
Well, I think it always has, and it's because it's a self-perpetuating organization. As long as the nominating committee is made up from the three past presidents, this is the sort of thing that you'll get. You know, I know when I was on the nominating committee, I made some deals. If you'll put with one of the other people, if you'll vote for so-and-so, I'll vote for your man. And I remember I had 3 years to influence the organization. And I have to frankly admit, I pushed some people in whom I had great confidence. Dudley Glick, Al Frank, Mike Heuer, and Herb Schilder. And I had to make some deals to get these people involved in the organization, either onto the board or into the executive committee of the organization, and then you're on your own. Then you either sink or swim by how well you do. But I always was kind of the guy who was the protector of the West.
Mm-hmm.
And and that might be lost now. I don't know. I just haven't paid close enough attention to how the executive is constituted. I think it's pretty good spread. I'm kind of pleased with the people coming along.
You mentioned deal making. I had heard that one of the deal makers in the organization was Jake Friedland.
Well, Jake kind of, Jake's always there in the background. I think Jake likes to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Jake loves to be a politician.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake's had a real impact on this organization. I think there are a lot of people who've been well placed within the organization who owe their position to the fact that Jake took an interest in them.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake's a wheeler and dealer, and what the hell. If you knew something about Jake's early struggle to even get started in dentistry, you might appreciate better what Jake is today. He had a hell of a time getting started.
I'd like to get into that, but I'd like to follow that one things a little bit more. Could you describe what went on in Jake's sort of special meetings or private meetings, the kind of closed meetings besides what the actual organization had?
Well, I'll have to admit I was never privy to that, so I can't speak to that. My dealings with Jake were always in the back of the room, just before the vote or something like that. As I recall, I didn't overlap with Jake as far as the presidency was concerned, and I don't think we were on the nominating committee at the same time. Jake had a falling out with me and Mike Heuer at a meeting because we suggested that the research for the future research direction of the organization be turned over to the research committee. And Jake wanted that to be in the control of the fellowship committee or the endowment committee. And he got very upset with Mike and me at that time. And that's why I always felt after that, I kind of led Mike into that. And I felt that after that, that I owed something to Mike. That's why I stuck my neck out to make sure that, that Mike got ahead in the organization, because I knew that you know, he needed some help. He was going to get anywhere in the group, and he's been a terrific contributor to the organization. But I've never been privy to any you know, backroom deals with Jake. Jake came onto the board before I left. He wasn't one of the originals on the board, and there was some opposition to Jake coming on the board because the academicians on the board, Jake, I don't think was associated with the university at that time. And the academicians on the board felt that the board ought to be more heavily controlled by academics rather than the practitioners. It gave us more strength, we felt, in our battle with the ADA. But I always felt Jake was a friend of mine, and I, you know, spent some lovely times in Charlotte with them and guest in their home a number of occasions, and he's been a hell of a contributor. Each to his own way of operating. Jake likes to work at the back of the room. I like to work up front. So I guess that's the difference.
Could you go into Jake's early struggle in getting into dentistry?
Yeah, well, you know, he was... Jake, if I've got the story right now, and I hope this is true, I think Jake has told me this, other people have told me this. Jake went to Emory. You know, he's a Jewish boy out of North Carolina, which was unusual in itself. Went to Emory, graduated in dentistry, did very well, came home, took the board, they flunked him. Took the board again, they flunked him. Took the board again, they flunked him. Finally, he finally says, "Hey, what do I have to do to pass this board?" Well, one of the guys on the board says, "You know, the trouble, Jake, is you're Jewish. You're not going to pass this board. You might as well go to another state." Well, he was persistent. He just kept taking the board. I don't know how many times he took it. Maybe I'm exaggerating. But nonetheless, he was flunked on that board a number of times just because he was Jewish. They told him that. You know, in those days, they were blatant about that sort of thing. And they just plain told him that's why he was flunked. He had made up his mind, by God, North Carolina was his home. He was going to practice in North Carolina. And he stuck with it till he finally, they had to pass him. And, you know, he ended up being one of the highly respected dentists in the state. But he was the first Jewish dentist in North Carolina. And he had to battle to get the position. And that's not too damn long ago, I remind you. So when you look back at Jake's early struggles to even get started, why, you realize that if he's thought of as devious by some people, why, maybe he has a right to be, the way he was tramped on early.
That's good.
He introduced my wife and me to Harry Golden, the Carolina Israelite. He was a patient of Jake's, the guy who wrote Only in America and For 2 Cents Plane and all that stuff. And so we were there visiting once, and Jake said, "I'm going to take you by the Carolina Israelite and introduce you to Harry Golden. If he likes you, he'll get out a bottle of bourbon. If he doesn't like you, he won't give you the time of day." So we marched into this office, funny old newspaper office. And so Harry said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Seattle." And he said, "That's great wobbly country." Harry Golden was an old-time socialist, and he was very taken with the whole movement of the industrial workers of the world, which were strong in the Pacific Northwest. So I knew something about the Wobblies, and I started telling him stories about the Wobblies. Well, he opened up a closet, got out the bottle of bourbon, and we knew he'd made it. And so we all went to dinner, and who else was on that? The guy from Alabama, the physician dentist from Alabama was there. But anyway, we all went out to dinner, And Harry got a little loaded. And we took him back to the newspaper office. And the last time I ever saw Harry Golden, he's wandering up the path toward his door at the Carolina Israelite, singing, "I dreamt I saw Joe Hill last night, coming down the road, an old wobbly song."
That's funny. Let me ask you one more question, I'll let you go. Did you have any contact with Nygaard Osby?
Oh, yeah. A lot of contact with him. Right.
Nygaard Osby.
Bill.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was in Seattle a number of times, stayed at our home. I knew him down here in Southern California and through the AAE. I saw a lot of him. He was a great favorite of Jake's, and Jake brought him into the United States, really engineered his travel through the United States a number of times. And, you know, that's something we owe a lot to Jake for, because he went way out of his way to bring Bill Osby over here.
Financially, I think.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that financially that, you know, that Jake was involved in this. I'm sure that he put up money to get Nygaard Osby here. And we learned a lot from this guy. He was, for his day, he was a sound clinician researcher. You know, by today's standards, why he wouldn't, probably his research wouldn't hold up as that all that great. But boy, for his time, why, he made some real contributions. And he was very popular as a lecturer. He was the one person that I knew as a foreigner who had a grasp of the English language. No, I'll take that back. Rafael Manana from Madrid, Spain. He's got that same potential for grasping the American idiom and being able to speak in the American idiom. And he made a tremendous hit wherever he went. You know, like all of us, as he got older, why, he became more and more philosophical and maybe a little more irascible. But he loved to come to the United States in the middle of the bad winters over there and hit the southern areas and play some golf and see his friends. And he had a real impact on us. I think I probably met him at the first one of Lou Grossman's congresses that I attended. Margarita Mirazabal from Argentina was at that congress. I met her. In fact, I made a lot of my international contacts from some of those early congresses that Lou put on.
I had heard that Bill Osby is given credit for introducing biologic principles to endodontics in this country versus straight mechanical principles.
I would say that that he was certainly had a tremendous influence on it. I'd have to think about whether he introduced it or not. But he certainly made us aware of the periapex, I believe. Believe me, he had a tremendous impact on me. I became much more interested in retaining my, or limiting my preparation and filling to the canal itself after seeing some of those biopsies, periapical biopsies. And after I'd seen this material of Bill's, then I went in and did a lot of those periapical biopsies and saw what was going on in the periapex, how important it was to obdurate the canal.